the Jazz Crusaders performing Way Back Home live at the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland in 2003. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and a program I hope you'll find useful today. The draconian programs that the Trump administration has vowed to implement to curb supposedly illegal immigration into the United States are having ripple effects elsewhere in the hemisphere. Several Central and South American countries are doing the same, expelling hundreds of thousands of people who previously were welcomed under a number of national and international humanitarian compacts, but now want their foreign guests gone. We have the great luck of having with us today Kim Ives, editor of the English edition of Haiti Liberté, one of the largest circulation Haitian papers anywhere, because it's not just in the United States anymore. It's available worldwide on the web. He has been traveling with Haitian exiles in Central and South America who, under extreme difficulty and bleak prospects, are trying to return home. And Kim, I imagine it is quite a journey. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Eutrice. I'm always glad to be on Lead Stories.
Thank you. Now, tell us what is happening. Give us an overview of what is happening and why you are there.
Well, to make a long story short, in the last 17 months of the Jovenel Moïse administration in Haiti, the number of Haitians who have fled the country to try to find work in primarily Brazil is about 100,000 people. And there had been many who had left Haiti. These are mostly young people under age 30, but also some older, who come to countries like Brazil, like Ecuador, like Peru, like Chile, and like Colombia in search of work and, if possible, a way to get to the U.S. border and get into the U.S., which is considered the gold standard. The situation in Brazil with the various electoral coups and judicial coups that have been happening there has seriously worsened. So many of the tens of thousands of Haitians that were there have left. Chile has now elected a new Trump-like president who's put the brakes on immigration into that country. And generally, we see a tightening up of the Latin American countries, which had been receiving Haitians. Often Haitians could fly to Ecuador or Chile without a visa. And now what's happening is they get on the Pan-American Highway, which runs up the spine of the South American continent. And essentially, the bottleneck is at Colombia. There's no road from Colombia to Panama. The Pan-American Highway ends essentially in a town called Turbo. And what happens there is that Haitians have to trying to migrate north, have to take a boat across a bay to a part of Colombia which has no roads. It's only boats and horses that move things around. And they go to these terribly remote towns, and this is in a part of the country which is a lot like Afghanistan, just sort of a Wild West scene with all sorts of warlords and criminals, coyotes are what they call the people who move migrants through the area, making a lot of money off of them. So they take the migrants who end up in Turbo, and they often drop them in a town up near the Panamanian border called Capargana. And there they pay about $200 for a 7-day journey through a jungle. And many have lost all their belongings en route, either because they had to ditch them to keep going on the terribly difficult trails there, or because they're stolen by various bandits and so forth that also plague that area. So essentially, they take a 2-day hike to get to the Panamanian border, and then they're handed off to Panamanian indigenous people who live in those woods, and they're brought to the southern terminus of the Pan-American Highway in Panama and continue on their route up through Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Mexico, and finally end up in the second big bottleneck point, which is Tijuana, where with Trump's America, they are not at all welcome. And so this is why I'm in Colombia and basically following this one of the theaters of this journey. It's one, you know, filled with just tragedy and broken dreams and a lot of people taking advantage of this human river moving up through South America, through Central America, and trying to get into North America.
And even so, the quest really is to go back home. What is the reception? What is the reception in Haiti?
Well, Haiti right now, as we've talked about on your show, Utrees, is in the grips, is in a sort of a headlock from a could call it a mafia clique. It really rose to power in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. The U.S. and our friend, who often is brought to attention on your show, Hillary Clinton, helped get Michel Martelly, sort of ribald Haitian compas singer, into power. And at the same time, unfortunately for Haiti, Venezuela was providing the country with oil, all its oil needs, about 20,000 barrels a day. And this money was being put into, or the sales of the money were being put in, sales of the gas, excuse me, were being put into a fund called the Petrocaribe Fund. And Haiti only had to pay 60% of the money it owed Venezuela for the gas up front. And the other 40% went into this Petrocaribe Fund, and it was payable back. It could be paid back over the course of 25 years at 1% interest. So Hugo Chavez's vision was that this would provide the capital for Haiti to build roads and schools and hospitals and clinics and all sorts of projects to help the people. Well, what happened when this mafia clique came into power in 2011, again with the help of the U.S. State Department, they proceeded to empty this fund of about close to $4 billion, which is a lot of money in Haiti. And a lot of this money went, you know, to buy the usual things, cars and houses and Swiss bank accounts and accounts in the Turks and Caicos, whatever. but some of it was used to elect Martelly's successor, a fellow called Jovenel Moïse, who presently holds power. So they've used this plundering, this pilfering of the Petro-Caribe Fund, which does have to be paid back. And I should also say that the Haitian government has not even paid the 60% it's supposed to pay cash-strapped Venezuela for the gas that it's used. It's about one year in arrears, in fact, more than a year in arrears on those payments. So the situation in Haiti is very, very bad, therefore, economically and politically. It's sort of right now in a state of unraveling, as I said in my article last week, doing a wrap-up of the situation. You have a police unit, for example, in the southeast went and tried to kick some people off of land where they'd been for many decades, and they wounded a young man, a 12-year-old, in the process of trying to take that land back. And the population rose up and chased the police away under a hail of stones. In the north of the country, in Cape Haitian, there was a meeting in a auditorium about this Petro-Caribe Fund, jam-packed. Somebody threw a couple of tear gas grenades into the meeting, causing a panic. One man was killed, the announcer of the evening, the MC of the night, and many people were injured. In general, we can say there is an uprising in the country about the plundering of this Petro-Caribe Fund. Now, the whole situation is about to be made much worse, Utrecht, by the fact that the U.S. government of Donald Trump is about to return to Haiti about 50,000 Haitians who are in the U.S. under temporary protected status. That is, they have the ability to get jobs and work, and they have been there these past 8 years since the earthquake when the TPS was granted. But now Trump has cut off TPS for most countries which had it. That includes Nicaragua, Honduras. Just last week, 57,000 Hondurans were shown the door. Salvadorians, 260,000 of them are being asked to leave. So these 50,000 Haitians are part of the expat community of Haitians, the diaspora, which helps support the country with about $2 billion worth of remittances every year. And so we see a very dramatic situation where even Haiti, even the government of Haiti said, please, Mr. Trump, don't send the Haitians back, because they know it's just going to be gasoline on a fire. So we have a very dramatic situation developing in the country, both politically and economically.
In light of that, what is being done on an international level? Because this is creating a massive disruption, not only in the countries where the Haitians are now, but anticipating that they're going to all be going back home, or this is what they're trying to do. They are people without a country, people without a status. Is there any indication that the international community understands the profundity of this situation and are trying to do something in a proactive way to at least get a handle on how you handle these hundreds of thousands of people, Haitians and others, in a state of total chaos?
Well, I think in a way, Utrecht, it's a symptom of the crisis of the world capitalist system, if I can say. You know, they want freedom of movement for capital, for their commodities that they're making in their factories, but they don't want freedom of movement for the third element of any economy, labor power. They want that to stay put, to stay in their prison, like Haiti, where you are receiving for a day's work $5. $5 a day. That is the minimum wage in Haiti. On May 1st, May Day last week, thousands of Haitian workers marched saying, at least give us a minimum wage of $15 a day. Not an hour, as we're asking in the United States, but a day, $15 a day. This is what they're demanding. The international community, if we often in Haiti, what that really means is the U.S., France, Canada, who are the three principal imperial powers, which call the shots in Haiti and have carried out the coup d'etats and the occupations of the past 20 years. This international community is quite content with this status quo, even though they see that the seams are starting to burst. You know, it's interesting, here in Latin America, there was a coalition of organizations, a coalition of countries called UNASUR, which was a kind of a counterweight to the OAS, what Cuba calls the Washington's Ministry of Colonial Affairs. And UNASUR, in fact, put a program in place saying we should not expel these migrants. We should not send them back. And so even in Colombia, reactionary Colombia, which is taking part in the assault on Venezuela, you see a case where they are not granting Haitians asylum as they're requesting, but they are granting them they're in a state of waiting for refugee status. So they've been put in this kind of limbo, and that's in the case of Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, which are the three principal states where this policy of putting people in a kind of a limbo. They have expelled in 2016 20,000 Haitians from Colombia, but right now the flow has gone down, and nobody is really sure how many are here. Of course, many people are hiding in the barrios, in the shadows, in small towns. That's one of the reasons why I'm here again in Colombia, is trying to find out what exactly are the numbers of people, where are they going, et cetera. So, but the international community, if we define it as those large former colonial powers of Europe and the neo-colonial power in the U.S., They essentially are doing nothing to relieve this the distress of these migrants.
Still, we have a matter of hundreds of thousands of people in a total state of flux. They are more vulnerable than ever because without some permanent place from which to operate, they entered these programs, or they took advantage of these programs when it appeared that various governments were willing to let them in, because, of course, they supplied close to free labor. Mm-hmm. Is there any indication at all that the United Nations understands that it, too, is responsible for this dilemma and this catastrophe, where you have hundreds of thousands of people who aren't sure what it is that they're supposed to do or what kinds of protections that they have, and who are now, on top of that, open to new levels of exploitation?
Well, it's interesting. The role of the UN, particularly in Haiti, is a terrible one. It has been primarily used since the coup d'etat against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004 as an occupation force. Right now, it is a police occupation force, but it's really the thin edge of the wedge. At any point that they need to bring in more troops, they can and will. UN has endless meetings about migration flows, but fundamentally, it has been turning a blind eye to the plight of these refugees that we've just been talking about here, but at the same time acting as billy club and rifle of the United States, France, and Canada, because they provide cheaper troops, Sri Lankans and Pakistanis and Argentinians and Brazilians. They cost a lot less than paying U.S. Marines to occupy a country like Haiti. So really, this kind of brings me to what, you know, is happening more in the grassroots here in the U.S. I mean, President Trump has really, we know already his enmity and hostility to any kind of international cooperation. He's, make America great again, America first. These are his mantras. And it was also in this vein that we know on January 11th of this year, he called countries like Haiti, like El Salvador, where these refugees are coming from, in many cases, shitholes, calling them shithole countries. And as a result, this caused a tremendous uprising in the Haitian community in New York, for example. In a matter of 2 days, there was a huge meeting at Haiti Liberté, and 6 days later, 1,000 people marched in sub 20-degree weather across the Brooklyn Bridge and surrounded or gathered in front of the Trump building on 40 Wall Street. They're looking to do that again on May 19th in Washington, to go out in Lafayette Park and rally. And essentially what these grassroots organizations are demanding is that Trump apologize to the countries that he called poop holes. I won't say it because probably there might be some FCC restrictions. They're demanding permanent residency for all TPS holders. There are about 400,000 people in the U.S. today who have been who have TPS and who are being terminated in 2019, or as in the case of the Hondurans that were just announced last week, the 57,000 Hondurans in 2020. They're also calling for the UN police occupation of Haiti to end, that the U.S. stop meddling in Haitian elections, that the U.S. and the UN pay reparations to Haiti for not just the crimes and exploitation that the U.S. has carried out there over the past century since U.S. Marines first landed in Haiti in 1915, but also, in particular, the cholera epidemic in Haiti, which the U.N. imported in October 2010. And finally, they're calling on the police in the United States to stop profiling and terrorizing, above all, black and brown communities. So this is the rally that's happening in front of Trump's house the White House, where Trump resides, on May 19th from 12 to 4 p.m. And hopefully actions like that, Utrice, will begin to make the international community, as we say, really take note that this is a crisis which needs attention.
I just want to ask, as a point of contrast, the Haitians and what they're going through, many other migrants are going through, their experiences are not at all the experiences of migrants from other countries, especially European countries. How is this so?
Well, as you point out, in that famous January 11th meeting that Trump had with a bipartisan delegation of Congress people, he was saying, you know, why do we want more Haitians? That was the quote. Why do we want more Haitians? And instead said, why don't we increase immigration from Norway? From Norway. So this, I mean, nothing could be clearer of the racist agenda of the Trump administration. Haiti Liberté now is suing the Trump administration, along with the organization FAME, that's Family Action Network in Miami. It used to be known as FAME Haïtienne à Miami. FAME, headed by the very dynamic Marlène Bastien. So FAME, Haiti Liberté, and 10 other TPS holders are suing the Trump administration with a group of lawyers, including the National Lawyers Guild, Ira Kurzban, who is probably the foremost immigration lawyer in the United States. His firm, Kurzban, is also part of that suit, and a few other firms. So they're essentially saying that the Trump administration's removal of TPS, stripping of TPS from Haitians in particular, is a racist move because it was completely arbitrary. And they themselves, Utrice, our lawyers just got through Freedom of Information Act a internal document from the Department on Homeland Securities, where they said it is too early to send Haitians back. The conditions do not exist in Haiti for us to send them back. And yet, that was in October 2017. And yet, 1 month later, in November 2017, Alain Duke, then the head of DHS, Department of Homeland Securities, said, we are sending back the 50,000 Haitians who have TPS. So we see, as they say in Creole, deux poids, deux mesures, two weights, two measures. That is, the European immigrants, no problem. Open the gates, bring them in. That's the Trump administration position, while Haitians, Salvadorians, brown and black immigrants, please go back to where you came from.
I know you have to watch time because you are following this process, but what logistically is next for these thousands of people trying to get out of a rotten situation, even though they're facing a rotten situation? As the Africans would say, digging a hole to fill a hole.
Right. Well, I think we have revolutionary conditions growing throughout the continent, really. There was a sort of a pink tide, can we call it, in Latin America or in the early part of the 2000s, which, again, I should say, was pioneered by Haiti with the 1990 election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. That was the first time that U.S. election engineering went totally haywire and didn't get in power the candidate with the most money. And then that started to happen across the continent. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Correa in Ecuador, Lugo in Paraguay, Lula in Brazil, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly the U.S. was faced with their backyard, or as they used to call it, in revolt or taking another path. And we saw the emergence, as we said, of UNASUR and groups like ALBA. These were all alternatives to the U.S. dominance of the hemisphere. But one by one, the U.S. has, with its agencies like not just the CIA and NSA, but the National Endowment for Democracy and its two tentacles. One is called the International Republican Institute, ERIE, and the other is called the National Democratic Institute, NDI, have been going throughout the continent and working and doing all sorts of very sophisticated coups and overthrows. We saw what happened with Lula using the judicial branch in Dilma in Brazil. We saw what happened to Zelaya in Honduras. We saw what happened to Lugo in Paraguay. And so one by one, they're taking back these countries. And what essentially that does, Utrecht, is it bottles them up and the pressure grows. And, you know, to me, in Haiti, the situation is not stable at all. We are the Haitian people are known for their uprisings, for their refusal to go back into the chains. And essentially, that's why the movement, which is organizing this rally in front of the White House on May 19th, it's called the 1804 Movement for All Immigrants. They didn't want to call it a Haitian coalition because it's not just Haitian organizations. They call it the 1804 Movement for All Immigrants because 1804 was the beginning of the end of chattel slavery in the world. It was the former slaves of Haiti which rose up and defeated Napoleon's army, created the first nation of Latin America, which was the touchstone for all the other revolutions in Latin America, in Venezuela, in Colombia. Bolivar was given the guns, the boats, the soldiers, the printing presses to carry out that process. And therefore, slavery, chattel slavery, began to come undone. But we see a new form of slavery, the slavery where you're condemned to stay in your country with a $5 a day wage. You can't travel and sell your labor power anywhere you'd like. In the U.S., for example, even though they can have their commodities and their capital moving freely, but your capital, which is your labor power, you can't sell it freely. So you got to stay put. And so it's a new form of slavery, and that's why the 1804 movement is going to get in Trump's face on May 19th in Washington.
Well, I'm sure you'll be telling us a bit more when that date comes closer. But in the meantime, I'm so thankful that you're able to connect us with a different reality and the continued suffering of hundreds of thousands of people. It's being ignored. It's not part of the knowledge base of the average American that these things are happening in their name, or that the Trump administration is principally responsible for this kind of chaos. But I want to thank you so much for your intrepid nature. You're hanging in there. You are following the story literally in the tradition, grand tradition of old news people. Thanks so much for being with us today, Kim, and be safe in your travels.
Okay, well, thank you, Utrecht. I hope the background noise of the Columbia airport didn't interfere too much, and always a pleasure to be on your show.
Sure, thank you. We'll take a break, come back, and talk about some other stuff right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrecht Lead. It is the day that the president has decided to basically dismantle, from his perspective, nuclear pacts that had been agreed to in previous administrations with Iran. you know, essentially, this is the prelude to the war that Israel has always wanted. And, of course, whatever Israel wants, the United States also wants. Benjamin Netanyahu has been wanting war, wanting the reason to bomb Iran. And he finds in Donald Trump a wonderful, wonderful friend and supporter. So we'll see how this goes. It is just another expression of the mental problem that I keep talking about with our president. The deliberate, wanton, and surreptitious moves that he makes that would appear to make no sense, but of course there's a shadow government that wants it this way. So the collective opinion of the people be damned. It's going to go the way the shadow government wants it to go. But we're going to be talking about New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who resigns at the end of the business day today. And already the list of possible replacements is long. You know how it works in politics. Oh, yeah, we're sorry that you got to go. But, hey, that's a job I won't mind having. Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York urged Schneiderman to quit after a New Yorker magazine expose reported that at least four women linked to him romantically said he was physically abusive to them. Now, we've been talking about who has the power to get things done, and this burgeoning women's movement is really beginning to chalk up impressive numbers of people who have been, in one way or the other, disposed of. But, you know, I don't feel sorry at all for any of this. I mean, I don't have any sense of sympathy for Schneiderman and so forth. But it does, I must admit, I do have a problem. I have some strange feelings about the idea that for all these years that Schneiderman has been in office since 2010, and even people in his position as, he's now former Attorney General for the state of New York, have been there, they've managed to deflect the demands of the people looking for justice, not in a romantic relationship, but they've been looking for justice, and they've been looking to the state for justice in matters concerning police killings. And we can't say that we've gotten any positive outcome for making such pleas over time. In major cases where police have just dispatched black and brown people in the state of New York, and all you get from the office of the Attorney General of the state of New York had been platitudes. No movement, no action at all. But you have four women coming forward and saying that in the course of their romantic relationship with Schneiderman, he physically assaulted them in one way or the other. He physically assaulted them. Instant justice. Instant justice. He's gone by the end of the day. Because now he's accountable to real people for real problems. And they essentially are of a personal nature. Nobody's asking, well, wait a minute. We don't know whether these charges are true. All they had to do was to step forward and make a charge. And it's as good as done. He's gone. And none other than the governor himself making the demand that he be gone. You have such incredibly controversial cases in the state of New York where people have been looking for justice from this particular office and the office of the governor, where cops have killed citizens, most all of them black and brown people, in which they gave us the reaction, oh yes, we're investigating. Nothing happens. Nothing has happened. But let four women come forward and accuse. They're not even filing papers or anything like that. These are not cases. They simply, at the stage, are women coming forward privately, talking to Ronan Farrow, a reporter who wrote the story that was published in the New Yorker magazine, about these four white women who said to him that they had relationships, they were in relationships with Eric Schneiderman, which is a private matter, really. It's a private thing. But that in the course of these relationships, he was very physically abusive. Well, okay. Nobody's asking for proof. Nobody's asking to see the complaint. Nobody's asking whether they went to a doctor and documented all of it. Nobody's asking any of that. They just came forward. They talked with him, Farrow. He writes a story. And before the end of the day, the state attorney general is gone. There's no further investigation needed. There's no trial needed. Just the accusation. Meanwhile, we had the same office incapable, and the governor's office incapable of securing justice, say, for the Eric Garner family, the man who was choked to death in an illegal and banned police chokehold. We have the Ramali Graham killing, where a police officer follows a young man who he had profiled on the street, follows him back into the house, and kills him in the bathroom without cause. And nothing happens. And there are thousands of cases like that, that seemed to be beyond the ability of the Attorney General and of the governor. We had perhaps, in my view, one of the most spectacular things to happen in that office. It wasn't Schneiderman at the time, but his predecessor, Robert Abrams. The state attorney general ordered the state legislature. I want you to follow the bizarre nature of this. The state attorney general, Robert Abrams, ordered the state legislature to take punitive action against Alton Maddox and to remove his license without any authority, without any cause, except to say that Alton Maddox embarrassed the state of New York as the lawyer for Tawana Brawley. It has never happened anywhere in the country where the state attorney general encourages the state legislature to vote such an action, which still, by the way, which still stands unanswered, and with the consent of the governor. It is a question of, you know, who has power. And there's no question that the so-called Me Too movement and white women who are part of the formula of white supremacy in this country, although they will deny it, they'll say it's on the basis of the human rights that they're advocating these actions, and they're succeeding because they're organizing, as if it has nothing to do with their support for white supremacy. But it dawned on me immediately when the news came that, well, Schneiderman is out. And why is he out? Has there been a hearing? Has there been a trial? Has there even been an official charge? None of this is needed. For black people and brown people in the state of New York, you have to go up and down all kinds of hills just to get to point one. The Garner case clearly was the result of Eric Garner causing his own death. Marley Graham caused his own death. Amadou Diallo caused his own death. Why should an attorney general, the highest ranking law official in the state, why should these cases constitute special circumstances that need to be investigated? But the same office that could be so discriminating and permitted to be discriminating, including with the approval of the governor. And by the way, who put him in office? Who put anybody named Cuomo, whether it was his father or himself, in office? But they get nothing in return, not even the modicum of respect, to say these cases represent special circumstances in our community. And we really do need to take a look at them. We really do need to investigate what process could possibly have yielded such injustice. No. So don't tell me about the vaunted role that the governor and the state attorney general have in the course of assuring justice. Instead, look at what they respond to. And they respond to the power, the actual and implicit power of white women. And the white women they don't mind it because they weren't a voice in the Garner case. They weren't a voice in the Romali Graham case. They weren't a voice and still are not a voice demanding to find out how it is possible that a governor and a state attorney general could order the suspension from the practice of law of an attorney against whom there has never been any charge of any kind, to suspend, to end his career, to suspend his practice of law because he proved to be far more capable than his adversaries. And they punished him. There's no crime committed. There's no crime that he has committed that's on the books to say that they're taking these extraordinary actions against an attorney. And when you look at the record, not even the Lawyers Association has any record of a charge that they have ever taken any disciplinary charge against Alton Maddox. He was singled out and he was prosecuted for a crime that did not exist and still does not exist. And they were allowed to get away with that. And by contrast, we have women quoted in a magazine saying that in their private relationships, we don't even know the veracity of the charges, in the privacy of their relationships with Schneiderman, they were subjected to physical abuse. Now, that's a real crime. It is such a big crime that the governor demanded by the end of business today, he's gone. So people talk about justice and racism and whatnot. The governor's Cuomo's administration is as crooked as you could get. Crooked, all the way. Schneiderman was crooked, all the way. Both put in office with a very, very healthy percentage of the Black and Latino vote. And yet Blacks and Latinos have to put up with their incompetence, deliberate incompetence, their racism, and their dedication to injustice. We have all these cases that should have been settled as cases that have been investigated with a definitive outcome. They can't produce such results. All these cases, blatant cases of police misconduct and brutality, nothing happened. Four women stepped forward and said, yes, he beat me up. Boom, you done. You gone for the end, by the end of the day. And it's not over. You still have to be brought before some kind of a court and the matter settled there. You see how it works? And people want to persuade you that these folks are interested in justice. They're not interested in anything but self-preservation. And they have open contempt. And I blame the black community for this, because in as much as you play such a great role, a significant role in getting and keeping these people elected, how is it that in matters that matter, you can't get to step one? You have outrageous conduct, and nobody is punished. Nobody's called to the carpet on it. And there we are. The same women who are complaining and getting results, by the way, because this is the nature of white supremacy. They have value. In the same cases that I talked with you about a couple of days ago, the complaint of a white woman nearly got four men actually, into very deep trouble, just on the basis of an accusation. And we were asking about the fairness of the trial of Bill Cosby. Well, that music means our time is up. I thank you for listening, and we'll return to each other tomorrow and continue the conversation then. Bye-bye.